Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. This is a Part 5 oral history interview with Ellen Hudgen, and her son Doug Hudgen is joining us. Ellen spells her last name H-U-D-G-I-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Ellen and Doug. How are you both today?
Fine, thank you.
Good morning. I'm fine.
Great. Ellen, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. And Doug, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. In part four, we specifically focused on the summer of 1956. So going back to part three, Ellen, you and I had talked about the Grand Canyon Airlines operations at the Red Butte Dirt Airstrip in the 1950s. And you'd mentioned that toward the end of the 1950s, business was picking up. Can you pick that thread up and we'll go forward from there?
Well, it was picking up. It just meant that both Palin and Henry, you know, were flying more. Business was not picking up enough that we needed another pilot and another airplane at that time.
All right. But they were spending more time flying the two planes that they had.
Yes.
Okay. How did that reflect into family life and your raising of the kids there at the airport?
Well, really, it didn't, for me personally, it didn't affect, you know, my time at all.
Okay.
It's just if they were too busy, you'd take lunch down to them. And, of course, at nighttime, because we had no lights on the field, and besides, you can't see any flights. In the dark,
right?
So, you know, when evening came, evening was the same.
Okay, and so there must have been like a pumpkin time, where both Henry and Palin knew it was time to get the planes back to the ground. And that would have been at their discretion and easy.
Right.
All right.
And most of the visitors wouldn't want to go in the evening time, you know, anyway.
Okay. Okay. So into the 1960s then, and so did anything else change? I mean, you're waiting for the kids to get out of school, and that day they get out of school, you put them in the car, and you drive north. The interstate highway system still hadn't been built yet in the early 1960s. I think that's...
No, you had to... it was quite a trek because you would have to... I don't remember when they changed the highway, the year. But in the beginning, you had to go through little towns and it took quite a while, you know, to get up there, and most of the time we would go, around.
You mentioned you had family in the Phoenix area or friends and would stop and spend the night there.
Yes.
And then carry on.
To give me a reprieve.
Yeah, which is good. Break the journey, and it would be helpful for the kids as well, because they were probably, you know, how long can you sit in a car?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, and then what do you recall about transitioning when you were first aware that there may be a transition from the airport there by Red Butte over to the new airport at Tucson, at the gateway community to the South Rim Village.
Well, the only way it affected me is because now Alan's wife, Margaret, and myself were working. We were behind when we got to in transitioning or when we were there?
Both. Let's start with transitioning.
Well, transitioning for me and for Margaret wasn't. Well, I really can't speak for Margaret because her children were much older than mine. And so, you know, I was more at home.
Okay.
And I don't remember that she really, I don't remember that until we were transitioning to the other airport that either one of us had anything to do with Henry and Palin. Just would, when people would come in, they would just take, they took care of the money and, you know, having people wait and so forth.
Okay.
Even if, even when we had another pilot at Red Butte, they did that. There was no one down in the office.
Okay.
No secretaries. The guys just took care of it themselves.
All right.
The pilots.
And do you recall roughly when you brought that third pilot in at Red Butte? I think you mentioned who that was already.
No, because they gave, I think they gave choices to the pilots. It was kind of like a vacation type of thing.
Okay.
For them. I mean, a change of scenery, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, all right. And they also would have been glad to get out of Tucson if you were using pilots from Tucson.
Well, we did. We used our own pilots from Tucson. We brought them up.
Okay. For a week or two at a time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Jim Hartman brought his family up eventually, and he moved up there year-round.
Yeah, he did.
Mm-hmm.
And when would that have been?
That had to be around 64 or 5.
Yeah, that would have been, when did we move on the new airport, Doug?
Not until, well, Aunt Margaret and Uncle Palin moved there permanently in 66. 66 was our first year of operating. Is that right? Yeah, I think it was. I don't remember if it was 66 or 67.
Oh.
But they moved up there during the winter time and moved into a trailer that was parked up
right.
The parking lot in like, front of terminal.
Like a small little travel trailer or more of a mobile home kind of thing?
It was a mobile home type of thing.
Okay.
Because they were living there year-round by then. And so that's why I think it was 66, but I got to put other things with it, because in 66 is when we bought the new Ford, and we went on a vacation. So I don't remember if we left for our vacation from the old airport or the new airport.
I don't recall that either.
Yeah.
Ellen, do you remember that new car in 66?
Oh, I sure do.
What kind of car was it? It was a Ford. What kind of Ford?
Station wagon.
Okay. Bigger than the last one.
Oh, yes. Well, not too big, because when Tom was the youngest, was, well, a year, year and a half, we bought well, he would have been two because it was August, or just one, I don't know. We bought a Ford. What year was a Dodge. What was the Dodge station wagon?
That was 55.
A 55?
Okay.
Yeah. So he would have only been a year. But it was a very nice car, and I got a wig. The wig came with the car.
Wait, what?
Oh, no, that was with the Ford, Mom.
Well, isn't that, yeah, not with the Dodge, with the Ford.
Yeah.
Wait, the car came with a wig?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Run that past me again?
Out because of buying a car.
That was, what, the incentive or something like that?
So would you kind of put that thing on like a raccoon skin cap to go driving around? Or, I mean, what were they thinking?
I don't know what they were thinking.
Oh, my gosh.
We used it as a practical. I didn't. When I say we, my mother used it as a practical joke. And she was very good at fooling her own, well, not her own sister. She knew immediately, but nieces and nephew and her own son. It was quite comical.
Oh, my gosh. Huh. Okay, so a new station wagon in 1966. Do you remember any discussion, Ellen, between Henry and Palin about the new airport and what it would mean for the family business?
Well, of course, we were expecting it to, you know, to build up, but when Bersolino got in it, it was nothing but politics, and it was not nice.
Okay, so before we started this interview, Doug had mentioned a man named Jim Bersolino, and is that spelled V-E-R-S-A-L-I-N-O?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Okay, well, we'll start there, and it might change later. We do a little digging. Ellen, let's get your take on Mr. Bersolino and his politics. What was going on there?
Well, like a lot of politicians, all they're thinking about is themselves.
Okay.
When they saw how well we were doing and how many trips we were having at that time, their eyes got a little green. And he was, Bersolino was with the state aeronautics, right, Doug?
Yes.
So that would have been the state of Arizona Transportation, Department of Transportation?
Yeah.
Okay. And so what was he trying to do then?
Well, he brought in, if I have my remembrance right, he brought in another company to also do flights over the canyon. We were, at that time, we were the only ones who were doing from the Grand Canyon. I don't know about other cities like Las Vegas and so forth, but we were the only ones that had a certificate to do that. This other company did not have that.
Okay.
That he brought in.
Ah. So, I'm going to have to get a lesson about airports and airport management. Typically, there's a license or a facility certificate that is given to an individual or a group to operate an airport. Is that right,
Doug?
Yeah. And I don't know what certificate it was, but I do know that there was a certificate. I think it was a certificate to operate a business out of an airport.
From the Corporation Commission?
Yeah.
Yeah, that fellow was from the Corporation Commission, wasn't he? Versalino?
No, he was the head of the Arizona Department of Transportation.
Oh, okay.
He was the bigwig.
Okay.
By that time, we had bought a de Havilland Dove, and we were flying from Red Butte using the Dove, going when. That went clear back to 1960. We bought that Dove.
So hang on a second. Let's stop right there and head down that tangent, because when I think of Hudgin, I think of Piper.
Yeah.
A wonderful relationship between the Piper Aircraft Company and its owner, and the Hudgins, Henry and Palin. And Ellen, too, who would fly out there and pick up a new plane and come back with it, or pick up planes for others and fly back with them.
Right.
How did de Havilland get in on the scene?
Well, de Havilland had an airplane that had more seats in it. Piper hadn't got there yet.
Ah, and how many seats are we talking, like from 6 to 8 or more? 12. Whoa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a twin-engine airplane.
Okay.
And when we got the Dove, that's when we started flying down in the canyon. And we changed from, we were in transition because we had Apaches prior to that. So we were using the Tri-Pacer, which was a high-wing airplane. Four place, and then we moved to, the Apache, and it was a 6 place low wing airplane.
That was the Piper Apache?
Yes.
Okay.
And then a year later, we moved into the Comanche, which was a 4 place low wing airplane. So by then, we had all low wing airplanes, and so we started flying down in the canyon.
Okay, because the wing, if it's down underneath the person in their seat, can't see the canyon through the wing of the plane.
Right.
So if you get down low, then the person can look out and up.
That's right.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, there are things to see below you also while you're flying, so they would bank the airplane
okay. In
either direction to do that. So they used the Dove quite a bit, and because of the Dove came in, by the time we moved to the new airport, we moved to the Cherokee 6, which was a 6-passenger single-engine airplane. And it had also a back door and a front door. So it was real easy to use that airplane as a sightseeing airplane.
Okay.
And plus the Dove. So all those airplanes flew. So by then, Dad and Palin never got out of the airplane. they sat in the airplane while we loaded the passengers in the airplanes.
So business was looking up, and you had people waiting in chairs somewhere,
exactly,
for the plane to come in, and then those people would get out, and then these people would get in.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the Dove, just to be sure, this de Havilland Dove with its two engines, was it an overhead wing?
No, it was a low wing airplane.
Okay.
So we would fly the Dove down in the canyon also.
Oh, all right.
A Dove is a British airplane. I don't know if you knew that.
No. Well, the de Havilland?
The de Havilland, yes.
Okay.
It's the predecessor to the Otter and the Twin Otter.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. and the Pipers knew that, and the Pipers, they in '64, we went to pick up a new airplane as a family, and they were working on a 12-place airplane.
Okay,
called the Navajo. And we would have bought that, I'm pretty sure, because we still were in love with the Piper family.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how it all worked, but all I know is Jim Bersolino, saw a way to get his hands in, I want to say, our pockets. And he pulled some shenanigans to give us competition. I don't know where these people came from, except Phoenix.
Okay.
And so we had competition. So here we are, teenage boys all working for Mom and Dad, Palin and Margaret.
This is you and your little brothers, Lou and Tommy?
And our cousins.
Okay.
We had invited our cousins up. And
this would have been Palin and Margaret's kids?
No, Palin and Margaret's sister's kids.
Oh, okay. The Palin's sister or Margaret's sisters or both?
Both.
Okay.
Dad and Palin's sister.
Okay.
And there was six of them.
Honey.
What?
Not six. What do you mean six of them?
Six of Aunt Jean and Uncle Richard's kids.
No. They had eight.
Well, they weren't born yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so, three of the boys.
Yeah, that's right. They had three boys. Gene and Richard did, and three girls. And the oldest girl moved up to the canyon, also, and worked out of the Moki Lodge. There.
Okay.
Yeah. She didn't work with us at the Grand Canyon Airlines.
All right. And I'm rocking back on my heels a little bit, thinking about Arizona Department of Transportation didn't acquire that name until a little later. They were the Arizona Highway Department.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I'm still kind of pondering how that all would have worked there. But I'm going to go back to Ellen. What did it mean for you when things started transitioning to Tucson?
Well, the first year that we were it was the first and last year, wasn't it, Doug?
Well, that's where I'm confused. I don't know, because I remember driving to the Tucson every day, you know, getting up at the old Grand Canyon Airport, because that's where we slept, was back in the duplex.
Okay.
And the lodge still, but we had to drive to the Tucson every morning.
But we were still.
And then
at the that's right.
We lived at the airport, but we worked at Tucson.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I remember the generator quitting and running low on water and stuff. So we had to stay at the old airport and get all that fixed one day. So that had to have been 67.
67 was your last year, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, 68, yeah, was the last year we flew up there.
Yeah, and that's when you lived at the Ranger's house.
Right, right.
Yeah, in 68.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so let's kind of drill into this a little bit. You mentioned before we started recording that the construction on the Tucson Airport started in 65.
I'm pretty sure it was, yeah.
Okay, and so it sounds like it was in operation by 66.
No, because as soon as it started operation, all operation at Grand Canyon at Red Butte stopped.
Okay. All right, so I can appreciate then that basically through the Corporation Commission or some sort of Arizona governmental organization, if they started, it's funny, they started the airport in Tucson, but they closed down your airport.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
Well, the reason they did that, there's a law or something or other, you cannot operate two airports within 10 miles of one another.
Oh.
You had to get our permission to even start that airport on Tucson.
And why did you give that permission? What was
we were stupid.
Okay.
Well, I think
we're good people.
It was more than that.
Okay.
Well, because Palin and Dad offered the state of Arizona the whole business, the whole airport, for free. And, I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. But the Arizona, Jim Versalino would have nothing to do with it.
So hang on a second. Was this to the point where Palin and Henry were clearly busy enough in Tucson and were like, we want to walk away from Grand Canyon? And want to give the entire operation to the state, or what was different? What was going on there?
It started earlier than that. It started either before or after the war, because they initially started business at Davis Monthan.
Right.
And I don't know all the story behind that, but they had a lot of ownership in Davis Monthan. And grading the runways and all that kind of stuff. And the government came and they wanted to give the operation to the Air Force. And they, this is where I think Lewis has more information than I do,
okay.
But they gave the business to, to the military, which was Davis Monthan, and they started Tucson International all over again.
Right.
In its present position.
Right.
So when the Grand Canyon thing came about, they did the same thing with offering them the, and the reason behind that offering Grand Canyon was the airport was already established.
Right.
You know, I think the state's contention was there's no water there. But they had already figured out how to get water to Red Butte from the Grand Canyon.
Right. There, I mean, there was no water at the time. The Trans Canyon Pipeline hadn't been built, and water was being hauled by train to the South
mm-hmm.
Rim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they had already figured that out.
Okay.
So, but Jim Versalino didn't want to have anything to do with it. So.
Oh, he didn't want to have anything to do with the Red Butte Airport.
That's right.
Got it, that location.
Right.
Okay. Even if the Hudgens were willing to give the entire operation to the state.
Right.
So the state would operate the airport, but the Hudgens would still fly out of there with their business.
Right.
Okay. So I can see now for Henry and Palin, it would be a good deal because they wouldn't have to grade the strip. They wouldn't have to, you know, keep the buildings going. I guess maybe they would. I don't know. But the state would come in as an operator.
Mm-hmm.
For lights and rescue, I suppose. I don't know what other things the state was doing in the late 1950s, early 60s to manage airports.
Right. They would have paved the runway.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That would have been a good deal.
Yeah. So there was, I mean, all kinds of pluses to do that.
Got it.
You know, they would have, I'm sure they would have rebuilt the buildings. The buildings they came up with were pretty nice, beautiful buildings. But that's, and when Versalino finished his doing his thing, that's when they started looking for ways to sell the business.
Okay, so I'm just trying to, and Ellen, please jump in if you have some thoughts on this as well. I'm trying to think about the other players in the area, meaning the Thurstons, and it. I seem to recall. I'm going to have to check into this that Bob Thurston worked out a deal with the state so that the highway alignment would go through that little valley of his property, and he would give the state the land for the airport. And I'm assuming that the Park Service must have been engaged in this as well. You know, looking at how do they sort of centralize visitation for visitors. I mean, I'm just throwing this out here, and I may be way off the mark, but it seems as though there might have been. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out Versalino and what else was happening in the region where people would have been. You know, everybody's looking to make a money off the tourist. And clearly, you know, Henry and Palin and the entire Hudgen family had a good business, a good operating business that was working well. And other people, as you say, are looking to say, how do we start getting into that market? Does any of that ring a bell about the other forces up there in Tucson that were thinking about airport expansion?
I don't recall any of that. I don't ever remember even hearing the Thurston's names. Lewis might, but I don't.
Well, someone started helicopters there. Was that after?
That was somebody before Halverson.
Yes, and that was Wayne. That was Wayne Learn.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Ed Montgomery had started in 1950. He ran for a year, the summer of 1950 into the fall, and had a number of problems and left. And he was the first helicopter operator out of that Tucson area. But then there was quiescence. There was no, as far as I can figure, until Wayne, I believe in 1967, started that commercial flying business with helicopters at that time. Does that sound about right?
Yes, it does to me.
Yeah.
66 or 67, there was a lot of helicopter traffic in operation.
Well, the pipeline construction to get water from the Roaring Springs into a pipe and down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, cross the river on a new bridge, and then go up to Indian Gardens just by gravity feed, and then be pumped from there up. That whole operation was being built.
And Halverson was doing that, wasn't he?
Halverson got the contract with a couple other people, and the Park Service engineers, Waldo Wilcox, does that name ring a bell?
Sounds familiar, but I don't recall him.
And Dan Cockrum, young engineer he was, they found Elling's pilots just a little on the wild side, and Wayne was much more, he was a little more, I think they saw him as being a little more safe, and about that time then Wayne started a helicopter tour business and was contracted by the park to fly park people into the park and out of the park. And I don't know if any of that sounds correct or incorrect to either one of you.
Yeah, because we didn't do as much as we used to do, so that had to have been what took place.
Well, when did Al Hudgen, when did the Hudgen family first get a helicopter?
That was in 1960, I think, because we got the boat in 1960. And I think we got the helicopter in 1960.
Ellen, does that sound right?
Well, I know the boat. I don't remember the helicopter.
Well, then let's talk about the boat for a minute. What kind of boat did you get?
It was a Glasspar Seafair sedan with a 75-horsepower Evinrude engine. And
And my grandson still has it.
Nice.
Lewis's son, Alfred.
Okay. And let's see. I'm trying to think of where you would use that. The gates to Glen Canyon Dam closed in 1960, and it was going to take a while for that reservoir to start. Well, it was impounding water then right away. Was this a boat to take up to Lake Powell, or where were you thinking to use it?
Lake Mojave.
Oh.
No, Lake Mead.
Okay.
I would have to
the drive, what?
It was an all-day trip.
Yeah.
I would say three-quarters of a day trip.
Yeah.
Would you guys go out to Temple Bar, or where would you take it?
We ended up at Temple Bar, and we left it in the water there, tied down to one of their buoys. And we would fly out to Temple Bar, and there was a runway right there close by to the headquarters there at Temple Bar.
Okay.
We would go boating for the weekend, especially while we were at the Grand Canyon, go fishing and swimming and skiing and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, my question then is, visitation on the weekends to Grand Canyon is going to be up a little bit. You would have had to, Henry and Palin, Al would have had to sort of walk away from a little increased business to go out.
Well, that's when we had, when we would take time to go for a couple of days. The whole time that we were up at the Grand Canyon, nobody had a vacation. Nobody had a day off, a regular day off. If it rained, that was a day off. Everybody would either rest or take the opportunity to just get in the car and go or something.
Okay.
But by that time, we had other people flying with us. And it wasn't over the weekend that we would go to boating. We'd take the weekday, because most of the weekends, well, not necessarily. So when you're, when people are on vacation, I don't know what days, but it wasn't specifically a weekend that we would take. And we'd only be gone for probably just overnight. Isn't that right? Doug?
Yeah, I don't really remember spending, say, two nights at the lake.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah. It's usually one.
Okay. Excuse me. So that makes sense. With a couple hours flight, I'm thinking to get to Temple Bar from Red Butte. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. Maybe an hour. I don't remember.
And then, I don't remember either.
And then you'd be there at the lake with the boat.
Right.
And if you brought out some groceries, did you have some camping gear then in the boat?
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. And then in the morning, you would return. Okay, that's all right. Then in the fall, you'd have to go actually drive out to pull that boat out of the water there at Temple Butte?
No. We would have the... we left the trailer there also.
Okay. So
they had an enclosed area to keep the trailer inside the gate or the fence there.
Oh, got it. So you'd have the marina people pull the boat out.
Right, yeah.
All right, that makes sense.
Yeah, we never saw the boat at home for several years.
Okay.
Until after we sold the...
Yeah.
So then the helicopter idea, was that Al's idea?
Yes.
Had to have been, yeah.
Okay. And did it get used as a tour machine at all before his accident up on the peaks?
Yes. It was mostly used for work and other kinds of work. But then it started, in the later years, it started getting used for tourists flying down. We did not advertise it initially, just to, you know, we just would kind of mention it if they didn't like what they saw. We had helicopters, a helicopter, and not very many people would choose it because it was more expensive.
Okay.
If people complained, it was about the price, and they wouldn't go on the flight because of the price. But it also got by word of mouth.
Okay.
And then later on, we started advertising it. We just started advertising it when the accident happened.
And was that 67 or 68? I'm off on that year.
No, I'm really confused on that also. I think that was, I know we got the boat in 1960. And I think the accident happened in 63, Mom, is that right?
That's what I remember, because didn't my dad die in 63 also?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. I'm totally wrong on that, and that makes sense. So again, my understanding of this, as far as helicopter operations at Grand Canyon for tour flights, Montgomery in 1950, then it would have been the Hudgens in the early 60s.
Yeah. I remember it being used by the Forest Service and a bunch of other people.
Okay.
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers who was using it at the time.
What were they doing?
I don't really know. It was something to do with building a landing strip on the mountain where the accident happened.
Okay.
That's who he had with him, was an Army Corps of Engineers guy.
Oh, right. They were doing the atmospheric study kind of whatever it was thing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, so that would have been 63. That the new airport starts in construction in 65 and is completed and operational in 67. Doug, when was your last summer there?
67.
Okay. And Ellen, when was your last summer there?
68.
Okay. And then in 1968, does the Hudgen family sell their operation to Halverson?
Well, that wasn't until 69, was it, isn't it, Doug?
I don't know when they...
It was somewhere between 68 and 69, because we never went back in 69, so...
Okay. And it's interesting, because right about that time, 68-69, Wayne brings in Elling as a partner, and then that is going to break down in another year or two or three, and Wayne's going to back out.
So I'll
see how much Lewis has that story. Let me look at the time here. We've been going about 50 minutes. I think what I'd like to do is focus in on the 67-68 time period. And I don't know if we have enough time to do it today. Is now a good time, maybe we'll just bring this up a little short, to put a comma in this interview series, and then next time we'll pick up the 67-68 time period, and then back to Tucson for a little while. Does that sound like a thing to do?
Sure. That works for me.
Okay. Well, with that, let's conclude part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ellen Hudgen and her son Doug Hudgen. Before we wrap this up, is there anything else that occurred in this sort of 1956 to 1966 time period? The boat came along. Well, the helicopter came along, but then Al's accident happened. Maybe let's pick that up next time. I'm just thinking about anything else that happened in this time period that we don't want to miss.
That's also the time period when all of us kids learned to drive.
Oh.
That's very important.
Because.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So, Doug, you were born in 1950 or 51, is that right?
50.
Okay. So, you should have been able to get your feet to the pedals and your hands on the wheels by 1958, maybe?
Yeah, I was 10, though.
Okay.
60. And, so we had gone to church that day, and Dad never went to church with us, but for this reason, whatever reason, he went to church.
The reason, honey, is he was busy flying.
Well, yeah, I know that. but Aunt Mary and Uncle Al were at the airport also at the time, and they took over Dad's spot, I guess, and Palin and was to. So anyway, we came home from church, and Aunt Mary and Uncle Al were sitting on the stoop of their trailer out behind the hangar, and Dad stopped to ask them if they wanted to come for lunch, and they accepted the invitation, and then Dad asked me if I wanted to drive. And, of course, I said, yeah. And,
Well, hang on a second. would this have been your first time with your hands on the wheel?
Very first, yes.
Okay.
Right after the invitation for lunch, Dad asked me to drive.
Okay.
And Uncle Al heard all the commotion that was going on with us changing seats and all that kind of stuff. So they declined the invitation for a free ride.
Well, they were going to walk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Up to the house, up to the duplex. So that was my first driver's lesson.
How'd it go?
Yeah. Without any accidents or anything.
Well done.
But from that point on, all of us kids learned to drive. Including Tom, and
how old was he?
How old was he? 6. Yep.
Okay.
And Lois was 8, because it was just a couple of weeks later that they enticed Dad to let them drive also.
Okay, so Lois would need a pillow or something, but Tommy would need like a box. I mean, how did he manage that?
Lewis didn't need a pillow, and Tom could hold himself in place by hanging onto the steering wheel.
Okay.
And,
so he's got to hang onto the steering wheel, he's got to steer, And he's got to stand on one foot so his other foot can reach forward to get to the gas.
Uh-huh. And so...
and the clutch.
And the clutch.
Okay.
So, and he would look underneath the steering wheel and between the dashboard and the steering wheel.
Okay.
So, so when it came time for the clutch and the gas pedal, he would pull himself up as close to the steering wheel as he could get and go through the gears.
So he'd hang on the steering wheel, get his feet down on the pedals for the clutch and the gas.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Dad taught Lewis and Tom how to drive in the Model A. And we had a Model A dual-wheel flatbed truck.
Okay.
At that time. So Tom could use one of his left foot to brace himself up towards the steering wheel by putting it against the box that the seat was built onto.
Okay.
In the muck. So that's how he ran into the hangar.
Wait. That's how he ran into the hangar. All right,
yeah.
So let's back up a little bit. Was this like the day he learned to drive or during later endeavors?
That was a later endeavor.
and before I ask him for his side of the story, how do you remember it, Doug?
Well, by that time, we were driving the Model A all over the property and the Forest Service property.
Okay.
We would drive that Model A. If there was a road, we were on it, and out in the woods.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Practice, that's what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so Tom and whoever, I don't remember, came back, and when they parked the truck, they parked it right in front of the hangar. And that's not where it belonged. It belonged out beside the hangar, a little bit in the back. And
they parked it where the big sliding doors were?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, right in front of there. So it was time to go home, and there was the Model A, and go put the Model A away. Not me. Tom drove it last. Tom, go put it away. So Tom goes to put it away, and of course he can't reach the gas pedal, and he can't reach the brake or the clutch, and he can't stop.
No, wait a minute. This wasn't his first time driving the thing. So he
no.
So
by this, it was not his first time, but he, you know, because he had to hang on to the steering wheel and get his feet all into position.
Right.
He didn't have enough time to stop. There's more stories to this. But,
well, carry on.
So, we were all, we told you about that little trailer that we would transfer gas into. That was parked on the inside of the hangar, on the opposite side of the wall where the Model A was parked.
So, were the doors closed?
We were closing them.
No, were the big hangar doors closed? I'm assuming that the Model A's front bumper is facing the big hangar doors.
No, it was parked not facing him, but parallel with the doors.
Oh, okay.
So he got in and he was driving it around to behind the doors and where the bumper would be facing the wall of the hangar.
Got it. So he's going to go forward and then hang a right or a left to get around the frame of the door, the big hangar doors.
Right.
And then pull up with the bumper facing the side wall of the hangar.
Right.
Okay.
So by then we had got all the hangar doors closed, and we were all standing there, just kind of talking about the day and stuff, nothing that I remember important. But we were all leaning against this gas tanker there.
Inside?
Inside the hangar, yeah. And all of a sudden, bang, that tanker goes shooting across the hangar. Because Tom had hit the wall and knocked the post out from one of the beams. And that post hit the tanker, and the tanker went shooting across the floor. And so nobody got mad. We just all started laughing. And I say we. I wasn't laughing. I was scared to death.
Oh, my God.
Dad and Palin, and I remember Jim was there, and I don't remember who all else was there.
Well, Uncle Walt was not there.
That's right. Uncle Walt was not there. So Tom came in all sheepishly and everything, and we're still they are still laughing, and we're all, us kids, are scared to death about what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Except we had to stay and redig the ditch where the pole got knocked out of the ground and stand the pole back up. And as far as I know, Uncle Walt never knew it. He was the hangar maintenance guy that was always there. Anytime us kids, anything happened, us kids did it, you know. So
you mean anything bad happened, you kids did it, or anything happened that needed some work, you kids did it?
Yeah, both.
Both, okay.
Yeah. It was always our fault.
So the Model T didn't come through the wall. It basically hit the wall where this post was and knocked the post forward.
Yeah.
Hit the tank, pushed the tank forward. Luckily, so the tank didn't hit a plane in the hangar.
No, for whatever reason.
Phew.
The airplanes were pushed way back into the hangar.
Okay. So
this was a, you know, up front close to the doors.
All right.
So there was nothing in the way except Lewis. Lewis, it barely missed Lewis by a couple of inches. Yeah. Lewis will tell you his side of the story.
Right, right. And so for Tommy, was that his first and only adventure in difficulties with pedals and things? Or did he have more of those?
Oh, yeah, a lot more.
Well, do tell.
Those years were, for us kids, I think, the most fun, because we got to drive, we got to get away from the hangar, or from the airport, and stuff like that. And the main reason for us learning how to drive was so that we could gas any of the airplanes, any of the transits, and any of the our airplanes.
Okay.
Dad and Palin and Uncle Al didn't have to do that anymore.
Oh, nice. And
yeah,
and how busy was that? How many planes were coming and going in transit that would stop in to get fuel?
Well, it depends. You know, there were some days there was none. There's other days where there was four or five.
Okay.
And there were other days where groups of people would come in. We had one time three civilian DC-3s come in for whatever reason.
Wow.
And another time we had, I don't know how many, Cherokee series, Piper Cherokees come in, and a bunch of French people were flying them.
Huh.
Yeah, they all came from Piper. And then that happened again with a bunch of Chinese people. You know, a couple, a year maybe later or whatever. So there was times when there was a lot of airplanes to gas up, and days when there was nothing except the sightseeing airplanes that we had to gas up.
And would you guys then make a, and how did you get fuel? I asked Ellen about this already, but let's go through it again, because I would assume that a DC-3 or three of them are kind of thirsty, and could take a substantial dent out of your fuel supply.
Well, we always knew, I should say, Palin and Dad always knew that they were coming.
Okay.
They didn't just show up. But somewhere along that time, and I do not remember when that would have been, huge tankers came in, and I don't, they were great big fuel tanks. We had one for 80 octane and one for 100 octane. And they were sat back in the woods above ground, and then they bought a bigger tanker that we towed around with a farm all tractor. And they, we pumped the gas out of the big tankards into this bigger than the one that shot across the floor tanker with gas-powered engines.
Hmm. Okay.
They were just Briggs and Strattons that had a pump on it. And it would take about 45 minutes to fill up the bigger tanker that was pulled by the trailer. So to fill up a DC-3, it took three loads.
So, whoa.
Yeah. So I don't remember how many gallons that bigger tanker held, but we had to fill up the DC-3 all the way to the top. And
that would take a while then.
Yeah, it would.
So what would the flight crew be doing while you were watching fuel move?
They went on in with the sightseers. Yeah, the Fred Harvey buses came out and picked everybody up and took off. So by then, I think we had telephones. I'm sure we did, because we had the, I know we did. And that was another thing. I went out all by myself to fix the telephone line when it broke down.
Which was quite often.
So let's open this up. Well, hang on a second. I'm going to put down phone as a separate topic. Let's keep focusing on driving lessons and then wrap this up with that. And then we're going to come back to the phone for next time. Did you ever bump into anything when you were learning to drive?
Never.
Okay.
Just
there's a halo there. All right. Ellen, do you concur?
No, I'm just laughing. I wouldn't know if he did anyway. I found out so many things that these kids did after the fact.
Well, that's how it's supposed to be, right? Well after the fact, long after the statute of limitations has expired.
Right.
No, I remember Tom and Lewis bumping into stuff, but not me.
Or I'll ask them for your story. Sam, what did he drive into? Yeah.
I probably messed up the car the most.
So how far did you guys drive away from the airport? What was the farthest distance? Because if you could work those roads, the dirt roads, you could get on the old Moki stage line and go quite a ways out toward Flagstaff. I mean, you could go a long, long ways. And off towards Supai?
Yeah.
Where did you go?
We never crossed the highway.
Okay.
64, I think it was. Or maybe still is.
Yeah, Highway 64.
Mm-hmm. And we drove to the south side of Red Butte.
Okay.
And even around it, we found a way to come around.
Fun.
Yeah. And we drove out to that ranch that was northeast of the airport. I don't remember that guy's name. As soon as we saw it, I turned around because I thought I was on property that I wasn't allowed to be on.
Got it. Okay.
We drove up to the, well, I also drove up to the, I guess it was Moki, Moki Lodge but I drove up there doing telephone line stuff.
Okay.
And that was in the Model A.
All right.
So we watched the gas tank, and we figured out we should not run out of gas.
That's a good one to learn.
Yeah.
Fun. Very fun.
Yeah.
How did you guys... what adventures did you have with speed? You have a 2 mile long dirt track right there. How fast could you go?
As fast as it would go. Literally. There's a straight part of the road there, and we would floor it.
Okay.
We had a Whizzer motorbike that I am now restoring up there, and we would ride that wide open, too. and I watched Lewis crash on it one time.
Oops.
yeah. But we would do crazy things with the cars, with the Model A and that Whizzer, mostly. We also had a 52 GMC that Uncle Al bought that we would drive, plus the tractors.
Okay.
So, yeah. But the GMC went too fast for us, but the Model A, I think Uncle Walt figured out that he wasn't stupid. He figured out that we were kids and he slowed it down somehow.
Nice.
Yeah.
Some sort of a governor kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We didn't know anything about mechanics at that time.
That would come later.
Yeah.
Hey, we can bypass this governor. Check this out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. All right. Well, this has been very helpful because I think it gives us a map for next time. This is good. So with that, we will conclude part 5 of Grand Canyon Oral History with Ellen Hudgen, her son Doug Hudgen. My name is Tom Martin, and Ellen and Doug, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Yes, sir.